Sí.
Vamos con el libro.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Colin Murphy, and I'm the deputy editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review. I'm also a board member here at the FCC. I'd like to welcome you all to our talk today, which is titled Euthanasia in Asia, the Need for an Exit Plan. Now, before we start, I'd just like to remind you to please switch off your phones. Thank you. We will have a Q&A at the end, so please hold your questions until that time. So I won't repeat the bio details, you have them in front of you, but suffice to say that our speaker today is the founder and director of Exit International, which is a voluntary euthanasia advocacy. He's also the author of two books, and he holds a PhD in physics from Flinders University and is a graduate of the Sydney University Medical School. To say that he's controversial would be understatement. Many countries and organizations have actually stopped him or tried to prevent him from speaking. So it's a great honor for us today to have him here at the club to listen to his views. Even though we may not share all of those views, I look forward to listening respectfully to his views and having a lively Q&A after the speech. So that's enough from me. With that, I'll hand over to our speaker today, Dr. Philip Nitzke. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Colin. That's a nice introduction. I'm very pleased to be here, and I actually am extremely pleased. I've had 2 days in this city. The first 2 days when absolutely in a new city nothing has gone wrong, and that's only happened twice before in my life. I don't know when that's going to change. I leave this afternoon. I might even get out of here without anything seriously going wrong. But look, I want to put a proposition to you today. I'm going to convince you in the next 30 minutes that you all need to know how to kill yourself. You all need to know how to do it effectively, and that you should take steps to not only learn the process, but acquire the things that you might need to take that course. Now, people say, well, that's a little over the top. Do you really mean it? And I say, yes, and I'm going to explain why it makes sense. In fact, the good way to start you thinking along why it makes sense is to get you to start writing down on the corner of your napkin there all the names of the people you know who are prepared to spend a decade in prison for you. Take your time, ask for extra napkins. The fact is, not many of us have a lot of names on such a napkin. Many of us will be sitting there staring bleakly at a very blank napkin. Because to ask someone to spend a decade in prison is to ask one hell of a lot from a person. And that's it's a very strong friendship or love that would allow someone to take that course. And the reason I ask such a question is, of course, the way the law is structured in Hong Kong, the way it's structured in Australia, the way it's structured in many Western nations, which says, in a sense, as it relates to end-of-life issues, that suicide is not a crime. You can go home tonight as far as the law is concerned and kill yourself, it doesn't matter. You don't break the law. That's not always been the case. There's been attempts, not only attempts, but there's been pieces of legislation in the past where suicide or attempting it was a crime, but that's gone. It's not a crime. But to advise, counsel, or assist someone to take that lawful course is a crime, and it's not a trivial crime. It's a serious crime. We're looking at a decade in prison as a possible outcome. Two of the states of Australia still have as a possible penalty for assisting someone to do something which is lawful, life imprisonment, the maximum penalty that can be issued by the state. Now, that's no other example in law of this, where to advise, counsel, or assist someone to do something which is lawful attracts any penalty, leave alone one of such savagery. And that, of course, is the issue, the reason I asked you to answer that question for yourself. Because if you find yourself so disabled, so sick, so uncomfortable that death is your preferred choice, and you cannot take that course yourself because you are so disabled by your illness, and you have to ask someone who loves you that much that they're prepared to take that course, they could be looking at a decade in prison. So you might find yourself in some time in the future rummaging around looking for that napkin you filled out here when you attended this talk at the Foreign Correspondents Club. looking for those names, because you might have to start giving them a call because you yourself have got yourself into a very difficult situation. So that's unfortunately the way the law is currently structured in Hong Kong at present, 2009, and it's effectively the same in Australia, effectively the same in the UK. It hasn't always been the case. There was a brief period in history in Australia where a change was made back in 1996. In a very remote part of Australia, the Northern Territory, where I'm from, a rather unusual place for progressive pieces of legislation. It's not normally known for anything progressive, the Northern Territory, quite the converse usually. But on this rare instance, they passed the world's first legislation, which allowed a person under very strict circumstances to get help to die. If you satisfied these rather arduous requirements, and they were strict, you had to be extremely sick, in summary. You just about had to be dead to qualify. You had to be that ill. But if you were that ill, someone could come along, a doctor, and help you die, legally. And I worked quite hard in the process of getting that legislation passed. It passed by one vote through the Northern Territory Assembly. And then, of course, it became crunch time for me because, having seen that law through, I then had to see it put into effect. And not long after the law passed, I was called upon to make sure that this law worked. A man who was dying of prostate cancer, who I'd got to know quite well, went through the very exhaustive process of assessment. Yes, he satisfied all the criteria needed for eligibility. And then he said, come around on Sunday, I'll die at 2 o'clock. It's a hard ask. Having worked hard and believing passionately in his right to make such a request, it now fell upon me to make sure that his request was complied with. I worried a lot about this. You don't lightly go around to someone's place, someone you know and like, and give them a lethal injection. I thought a lot about it and thought, I don't want to sit there and give him a lethal injection. I'll build a machine that gives the lethal injection and I will sit on the other side of the room. The machine will do the delivery of the drugs. I wasn't trying to escape responsibility. I knew that I still had to put the cannula in his vein and I knew I had to load up the machine with the drugs. But at least I wasn't in his personal space. I could be on the other side of the room. His wife, the person who should be in that personal space, could be with him. I arrived around there on that hot September afternoon. Darwin is a tropical area, monsoon conditions. It wasn't part of the wet, but it was hot. I tried to have lunch. What do you talk about? It's very difficult. Every sentence you're about to say, you run through yourself, you run past yourself in your own mind, and you think, oh, I better not say that. It's got some future component to it. So you edit yourself, and you don't say that, and you don't say this. You talk about, as we did, looking at the football on the television. Very hard. My mouth was so dry I couldn't eat anything, and I didn't quite understand why. I looked down, my shirt was soaked in sweat, and it wasn't that hot. These are all the signs of extreme anxiety, and people said, ah, that's because you knew you were about to break a fundamental law. Well, it wasn't that at all. It was because I knew that I was going to be called upon to make sure that this worked. I was anxious about it. I was on my own. I was by myself. I couldn't fail. I couldn't say, oh, I forgot something. Let's do it tomorrow. 2 o'clock, Bob Dent was to die. And at 2 o'clock, he went and lay down and said, let's do it. And I got the cannula into his vein. It was a good thing because that can be sometimes quite difficult. I loaded the machine with the drugs. I presented him with a little laptop computer, which was part of the equipment, part of the machine. It presented 3 blunt questions to him. The third one said, if you press this button, you will die. Do you wish to go ahead? He pressed the button. He pushed the machine to the side. He held his wife, Judy, and he died in her arms. And I was watching from the other side of the room, and my overwhelming feeling was, well, there were two. One was that this was the first time this had ever happened. A legal, lethal, voluntary injection had been administered. And the second thought, one was immense relief that the machine had functioned. And 3 more times I was called upon to do that before that legislation, that world first law, was overturned by the federal government of Australia. And Australia went back into the dark ages legislatively, which is exactly where you are, with the same pieces of law that I outlined at the start. That groundbreaking legislation was overturned. The machine had no further use, of course. It doesn't have any role when there's no legislation. It was acquired by Australia's major museum, but there was an argument in the Federal Senate of Australia. One senator got up and said he didn't want the children of the nation being traumatised by that obscenity. The museum got cold feet, rang me up and said, hell, if you give us that, it'll sit in the basement for 50 years. We can't display it. They said, change your mind. They advised me. So I did change my mind, and I was contacted immediately from London. And the British Museum said, we want the machine. So I said, good, and took it to London. And a little handover ceremony there with the director of the British Museum. And I was going on about how enlightened the British are because I could display the machine. And he said, well, it's not as though we're so enlightened. We're 12,000 kilometres away, and you need that distance on an issue like that. He said, besides, we can display it as some quaint artefact from the colonies. We don't have to start taking responsibility for it. Which was comforting, but he went on to be more reflective and said, when a country is comfortable with its own history, it can display the icons of that history, and Australia is not comfortable with its history. And anyway, now, I mean, I was over in London recently. It sits in its glass case there. It's in a very prominent position. I'm very pleased. It's got James Stevenson's first steam engine on one side of it. It's got Logie Baird's first television on the other side, and I don't know whether it qualifies for such eminent company. But I'm proud that it's there. And I watched thousands, it seems, of British schoolchildren filing past seemingly untraumatised by the obscenity. But Australia could not display that machine because Australia is not comfortable with its history on that issue. We have gone back into the Dark Ages, and our legislation is the same as yours. Now, I'm not suggesting here that legislation solves this problem, that if you set up strict conditions, that people under those strict conditions can get help to die, that solves the issue. It doesn't. There are still problems. It's very hard to take a dying person through that exhaustive assessment process. You drag them from this doctor to that doctor to a psychiatrist to have their sanity tested, and they resent it. They're dying people. Bob Dent, when I finally managed to get the four signatures we needed on that piece of paper, I said, you've qualified, Bob. He said, wow, I've qualified to die. Yes, you've qualified to die. And that's what legislation does. It sets up a barrier and it puts in place the people who control that barrier, by and large, the medical profession. And many people don't think that's very satisfactory. Many people say dying is a natural process, as it is. It's not a medical process. Let's not medicalise it. Let's not give the keys to the gate to the medical profession. I make that decision, no one else. And one of the observations I made during this period was that none of those four people that went through that process would have taken that step had they had their own bottle of the premier euthanasia drug, Nembutal, in their cupboard. They simply would have gone to the cupboard when the time was right, taken the drug out, poured it into a glass and drank it and died. But, of course, that wasn't an option. So they used the law as a second best option. So when we talk about the issue, I don't want to give the idea that it's all going to be solved as soon as we bring in legislation. But nevertheless, what we have now is a jungle. People get caught up in it regularly. There's a procession of people through the courts of the various countries of the world caught up in this act. These are not criminals. They're not people that have ever broken the law. They're people that are caught up in a situation where they desperately want to help someone they love and they're prepared to do anything for it. Last year in Australia, through the Supreme Court of Sydney, a man who was a Qantas pilot international, in and out of Los Angeles all the time, retired, found himself not thinking too well, went to his doctor, heard he had Alzheimer's disease developing, decided, I'm not going through this process, I'm going to end my life, tried twice to die and failed. And this is an important point. It's not that easy to kill yourself. Don't get that idea that you just go home and take a few tablets. It's not that easy. You need to know what you're doing. Clearly, Graham Wiley didn't know what he's doing. He failed twice. And then he went around looking for that serviette I've got you to fill out, looking, and he had two names on his. He had his wife's name from 18 years. She loved him enough. And he had his best friend of 35 years who actually worked for us, a woman who was dying of cancer, interestingly, but still quite active and ambulatory. And he begged these two women to help him. And Carol, our staff member, went to Mexico and she brought back the drug. She gave it to Graham's wife, Shirley. Shirley gave it to Graham. Graham poured it into a glass and drank it down and said peace at last and got the peaceful death he wanted and left behind one hell of a mess. The doctor wasn't happy, wouldn't sign the death certificate. An autopsy was done. They said, where did all this Nembutal come from? That's an illegal drug. The police put phone taps, intercepts on both of the women's telephones and collected information over a 3-month period, and then they moved and charged them both with assisting a suicide, and they were both put on trial in the Sydney Supreme Court. In fact, the prosecutor said, we can go further than this. This man had Alzheimer's disease. He couldn't have suicided. this interesting concept. If you've got Alzheimer's disease, you can't suicide because you don't have the capacity to suicide. So he said it must have been murder, and they were the charges were changed to murder. And both women were found guilty in front of the jury. I spent a day and a half on the witness stand. I knew the man who died, and it was a torrid process, but the prosecutor there, a formidable presence, tore those two women apart. And they both broke down, and these two women who hadn't broken a law previously in their lives were effectively destroyed. The jury found them guilty of murder. Karen, they were on bail pending sentencing, and Karen said to me, I'm not going to spend my last days in jail, and she took the other bottle of drug that she'd brought back from Mexico, and she died before sentencing. His wife stood there and received her sentence. She's in prison. She's a broken woman. Relatively modest sentence, but she's still in prison. She's lost the house she's lived in for 18 years. You can't inherit from the man you just murdered. She's $500,000 in legal debt. It's a destroyed two people because Graham Wiley didn't get his act together. He was in and out of Los Angeles. He could have slipped down to San Diego, crossed into Mexico and brought that drug back a long time ago, which is where I'm coming to. When I'm saying to you, while you're here and still able to get around a lot, don't leave it to the point where you're having to beg that person to go over to Mexico for you, because the risks that you expose them to are extreme while the law stays in its current form. So that's the point I'm making today. Don't do a Graham Wiley. Think ahead, because it makes sense. You may never want that drug, but if you've got it in place, it's an immensely comforting feeling, and it's an insurance policy which lets you know that you're not going to be get caught up in what is harsh and inhospitable legislation. Now, I want to finish off by saying a couple words about censorship. The Australian government has got enthusiastic in this issue of controlling the flow of information about end-of-life issues. It's quite amazing, really. Australia is leading the world now in controlling the flow of information, censorship, in fact, and they've moved it from the traditional areas into areas which it previously didn't have much of a role, and they've decided in recent times, the best way we can keep our elderly Australian population happy and living longer is to keep them totally in the dark. The idea that if you don't know anything, you live longer and happier lives. And they've done that in a couple of ways. And one of the ways they've done it is that they've banned my book. The book here, which I wrote, was selling very well and keeping me going. And they've totally banned it. Not just a little bit banned it, totally. It was appealed by the Federal Attorney General in the Australian government. Sorry? Oh. Yes. Well, it's not banned here. They appealed it. Philip Ruddock, the then Attorney General, they decided it had attracted the RC classification in Australia, which is the most severe classification. I didn't know anything about classifications. RC, I said, what's that, Roman Catholic? I didn't know what it stood for, but it actually stands for refused classification. And it's so severe that this book is so evil that its mere possession is a crime. So it all had to come out of all the bookshops and be shredded. That was the Australian government's contribution to free and open debate on this issue. And where can we get it? Well, you can get... So it's no trouble. The Americans, of course, don't have this problem. They publish it quite happily. It sells well on Amazon. The New Zealand government said, oh, well, we'll go halfway. You can print the book, but you've got to make sure that 30 pages look like that. So we've got 30 blacked out pages of the dangerous information in the special New Zealand edition. To take it further, the government's decided that we can't have people getting this information on the internet. We're going to have to move into the area of mandatory filtering on the internet. Now, the Australian government's going in this direction. It's the first Western nation to do it. It's quite unexpected. Whenever someone tries to argue about why are you doing this, they say, well, we've got to get and control the internet. There's dangerous information out there. If anyone questions it, as some of the senators have done from the opposition in Australia, they say, what, are you a person who wants child pornography? That wedging of people who try to argue for the role of free speech in this issue of internet regulation, it's a difficult path to tread. And I think the federal government in Australia is going to get their way and introduce mandatory filters on everybody's internet site. Now, we were worried. We said, well, which sites are going to be banned? Which sites are going to be blocked? And, of course, the government wouldn't say. We can't give out the list because everyone will go and look at them. So what happened? WikiLeaks published the list. It was leaked over in Scandinavia, and of course everyone said, oh, here's the list, 1,000, and what a surprise. We looked down it, and there right in the middle is us. our organisation is there. Now, we are not associated with child pornography. Most of the websites were pornographic sites. In fact, in an opinion piece in the Sydney Morning Herald very shortly after, the question was posed, what are the three websites listed have in common? The first one was www.pantyarse.com, www.peacefulpill.com, and www.pickyourperversion.com. They're the P alphabetical listings of the banned list. And we're in the middle of it. And so, unfortunately, is some hapless Queensland dentist who, for reasons totally unknown to anyone, somehow or other got himself on the list. And this is a problem with this censorship, that you don't know who's being censored, there's no right of appeal, and that's the way the federal government is going. So this idea that you keep people in the dark and they live longer and happier lives, I'm very sceptical about. People live longer and happier lives when they're empowered with information. Give people information, they live longer. It's a paradox, perhaps, but if you give people the option so that they know about the drugs they need, if they get a bottle like that from Mexico and they put it in the cupboard safely, they live longer. It's a paradox. People say, you can't go giving that stuff out. People will be out there in the streets of Hong Kong swilling it down, dropping in the gutter. The only reason we're alive on this planet is because we can't get Nembutal. It's rubbish. When people get the knowledge, they stop worrying. When they stop worrying, they live longer and happier lives. And we see so much evidence of that. So that's really the thesis benefit. The thesis I'm putting to you is that you will benefit from finding out for yourself and taking steps to make sure you've got that option covered. And I'll just finish off now by saying a little bit about the drug. It is the best of the euthanasia drugs, Nembutal. It's got a long and proud history. It was developed back in the 1850s by the German organic chemist Bayer. It was first used as a sleeping tablet. In the 1950s, all of the sleeping tablets in the world were barbiturates. And many people realised if you took a lot of them, you did more than sleep, you actually died. You went to sleep and then you died. And people like Marilyn Monroe, Judy Garland, Jimi Hendrix died taking Nembutal. And then the drug, of course, fell out of use because newer, better, safer sleeping tablets became available. The first was Valium, and now there's hundreds out there. And they're non-lethal. As they used to tell us in medical school, you can take a bucket full of Valium, you probably won't die. You might sleep for a long time and you might die, but they're not lethal. The thing about the barbiturates was they were lethal, and that's what makes them so useful now. But doctors have no access to them. They're not used in the medical profession anymore. No good going to your doctor and dropping to your knees and throwing your arm around their ankle and begging them to help you. They can't give you Nembutal. Vets have access to it. Now, what are you going to say? Vets use it in two forms. They use it in this bottle form, a sterile form, for an anaesthetic agent for surgery on animals, and they use the same drug to put animals down. So what are you going to say? You're off to your vet. Look, I want to operate on the cat this weekend. I've got to have a bottle of that drug. Clearly met with a degree of scepticism. So you can't get the drug. I've known five people to get that drug in the space of the last 12 years in Australia from an Australian vet. And they've had very special circumstances. The most colourful was an incident when I was talking to a man who was dying, a quite nasty cancer. His wife was present. He was asking me what his choices were. He said, I can't go on with much more of this. What can I get? Can I get that drug? And I said, do you know a vet very well? And he said, how well? And I said, well enough to spend a decade in prison for you. And he said, don't be silly. So we moved on and we talked about other things. Other things, other drugs. There are a few, not many. Nowhere near as good as Nembutal. We talked about other things, but his wife at the end said, come out and have a cup of tea. So I went out to the kitchen with his wife, and I sat there with his wife, and she started to talk again, and she said, you know when you were telling us about getting the drug from a vet, and you said, do you know a vet? And I said, yes. She said, look, my husband knows nothing about this, and I don't want him to ever know something, any about this. He's a very sick man, and I don't want him to ever find out. And I'm wondering what she's about to say. And then finally she says, well, all right. She said, it's like this. I had an affair with a vet. He owes me some bloody big favours and I'm going to call him in. And I just looked at her. And she had a grim and rather determined look and she got the drug. And she gave it to her husband and he did like many people did. He felt immensely comforted by the fact that he was back in control. He put it in the cupboard. He knew every day as he woke up and life was dreadful that he knew that if he wanted to leave, he just had to pour it into a glass and drink it and he had the peaceful death he craved. And he didn't do it because he was in control and he died of his cancer. And that's what that drug often does. It extends life. But it taught me a lesson. The question at the bedside obviously should be, have you had an affair, Vivette? Seems to be a... And I said that to a large group of elderly people. I usually speak to large groups of elderly people, and someone up the back yelled out, wish you'd told me that 40 years ago. And I also mentioned that in New Zealand recently, and it was reported in the New Zealand press, and next thing I got a quaint letter from the New Zealand Veterinary Association arguing that I'd somehow or other impugned the moral and ethical standards. But very sensitive are vets. So that's the point, that's the drug. But you can't get it from a vet easily, obviously. It's very difficult, but you can get it from going overseas. Make sure you know what you're trying to do. One of the reasons that we've been able to, it's what's important about getting the material out there, is that by giving people a look at what the drug looks like, people get the book, tear out the pages, and head over to Mexico or Venezuela or Bolivia or Peru or Ecuador and get this drug lawfully. And if you want to die there, you don't break any laws. If you want to come back to Hong Kong, you start breaking the law because you're importing a legal substance. And, of course, I wouldn't be suggesting that you do that. But nevertheless, it is a very wise thing to do because none of us know what's going to happen. Putting these options in place gives us that ability to have our insurance net, our insurance policy in place, because it could be a long time before the Hong Kong authorities and certainly before the Australian authorities change the legislation, the insidious legislation that forces so many law-abiding, loving citizens to break laws that could lead them to long periods of incarceration. So thanks for the chance to talk to you today. I hope there's some questions, and I've really enjoyed being here for 4 days. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Just on the issue of questions, can you please state your name and your affiliation? Keep your question short, and please let it be a question, not a comment. Okay. And let's start with one question per person for now. Vodine?
Hi, I'm Vodine England from the BBC, so I have trouble with microphones. Are you aware from your research on the subject of any particular difference between attitudes to this issue between the West and Asian cultures?
Look, one has asked me that a little because people are saying, well, when you come to Asia, what are you going to find? Is it going to be the same interest in this topic? Is there going to be cultural differences which you need to be aware of and certainly accommodate? And I was being somewhat curious to find out the answer to that question myself. The reason that I initially was thinking that it probably won't be a significant one is because we are getting an increasing number of contacts from people in China and from people in Hong Kong. We get regular emails on a daily basis from people asking the same sort of questions that we're getting from around the world. Look, I'm in this situation, I've got this problem, I want to get the best drug. Basically the same question. And I see the interest in this issue as significant enough in the East for me to come along here and talk about this issue in general terms and probably hold public meetings and workshops. Our planned workshop in Singapore had to be cancelled when the Singapore authorities cancelled our venue. I'm very curious about, and that's also happened in Dubai, and we've got trouble in Vancouver. But I'm very interested in the idea of running the sorts of public meetings that we have been able to run so successfully in the US, in New Zealand and the UK here, just to really put one's toe in the water and see what happens. I'm not suggesting that we won't find significant differences, and I'd no way pretend to be knowledgeable about those issues. I think by treading carefully, though, what I'm going to find is that amongst elderly folk, the same issues will remain. People want good information.
Okay, this is breaking my rule, but yeah, Vadim, go ahead.
It's a different question, honestly.
Oh, good.
You're actually here to promote a new TV program. Could
yes.
you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, I heard about this program, and I got and talked with Robert Char, who's here, and he told me about his plan, and I was rather intrigued. I thought this is a very, it's so hard. By and large, this issue is not one that you find any... One, apart from the spectacular aspects of it, the way it might result in certain spectacular news and current affairs shows, you don't find anyone generally within the television industry wanting to explore the issue as in greater depth. And I was so taken by that contact and the suggestion that we should come over here and talk about it, then there would be a debate run on the show, Dignified Departures, which some of you will have seen when it ran the other night. that it was something that was unique and well worth participating in. And my understanding is it's about to be finding its way into China too. So it's a way of us finding out what the attitudes are and at the same time allowing this discussion to take place here.
Philip, thank you. Isn't this inevitable, euthanasia in Asia, when you look at the fact that in 20 years' time, 30% of the population will be over 65?
Yes, look, that there is an inevitability about it, which makes me think I'm basically on a winner here. I mean, you run around and you think, must be awful, everyone hates you, but it's not true. I mean, whenever you survey, and these surveys have been done all over the world, basically the same question is asked. If you're suffering no hope of recovery, do you think you should be able to get lawful help to die? You will find out there in the streets of Hong Kong, I bet, around about 60 to 70% of people saying yes to that question. It's almost a constant in Western society now, running at about 70%. It wasn't always like that. The question started to be asked back in the late 50s when it was roughly 50-50, but it rose steeply, really as a consequence of some of the developments in Western medicine and the aging of the population. So with so many people wanting a change and wanting a different situation, it's going to take place. So sooner or later, the laws will change, and that's comforting to know, and that's certainly one of the reasons why I find it an important issue to be involved in. The discussions that we spend a lot of time with now are trying to work out ways that people, while they're waiting around for the rather reluctant changes to these laws, there's nothing more reluctant than the politicians involved to try and bring on legislative change on this issue. What people can do in the interim. Most of our members are 75 years old and they said, look, I can't wait another decade for the politicians to get off their asses and do something. I want to know what I can do in the interims, which is why we spend so much time talking about the drugs. But take the bigger picture, step back a bit, of course it's changing. When the territory law came in, it was the first in the world. Now we have, since the territory law came and went, we have Oregon, we have Holland, came in 2001, we have Belgium, we have Luxembourg, we have Washington State, we're about to have Montana, there's Switzerland out there. Interestingly, the only one of these places which is, allows you as a foreigner to come in and take advantage of their legislation. All of the other places have strict residential requirements, but the Swiss are to be applauded because not only have they got civilizing legislation, but they don't close the boundaries and the barriers to people who are not Swiss nationals. So the world is a much different place than it is now than it was 12 years ago. And you'd be a foolish person, I think, to say that it's going to stop here. Sooner or later, you're going to see legislative change in Hong Kong.
That's a good question. Can you talk a little bit about the dangers of involuntary euthanasia? I mean, the abuse of euthanasia, people using it in illegal ways to kill people who don't want to die.
Oh, I mean, if you're looking at legislative models, for example, and asked about the abuses that might occur, people often refer to the idea that there'll be some form of slippery slope and erosion of the standards. Now, in all of the legislative models that I'm aware of, and certainly the one I worked under in the Northern Territory, the conditions were strict. You had to be able to articulately ask for help to die on the day of your death. So you couldn't be slipping into a coma, you couldn't be a person who was losing clarity of mind and thought, you had to be conscious. And people said, that's not fair on people that have got dementia, and maybe it wasn't, but you had to be clear of mind. So how can that erode and change to people saying, well, it'll start off as voluntary euthanasia, and before long it'll become involuntary? Well, hard to see how that legislative model would have become involuntary when you had to ask for it. And people said, well, family members will be putting pressure on people to do the right thing. I've seen no evidence of this. I guess it's possible. It might be possible. Maybe there are some families out there urging grandma to go and ask for euthanasia. So when that she is exhaustively questioned and taken around to doctor after doctor, she sits there and maintains the mantra, I want to die, without saying it's really my son and my daughter who are asking me to say that. It's possible, but the question really is, are we going to use the fact that that might happen as a way of disenfranchising the people who want that option and clearly benefit from it? And that's the argument. In terms of issues that might come about from the rather illegal backyard processes, the so-called do-it-yourself euthanasia, which goes on now, that is the acquisition of drugs like this, are there dangers here? Yes, I suppose there are, but one of the dangers, people say, you can't go letting people have that drug, they'll be out there murdering their grandmother. It's not that easy, actually. This drug might look like water, but it sure as hell doesn't taste like water. It's exceedingly bitter. You can't slip it into your grandmother's tea and expect them to just drink it down and die peacefully. They'll spit it straight out again. So the idea that it can be used to facilitate murder is not particularly likely. So the idea of getting the drug now, in the interim while the legislation is in such a mess, keeping it, it's got a shelf life, interestingly, of 15 years, so if you're thinking that sometime between now and 15 years' time you might want to die, I'd make that trip and get that bottle and make sure it's kept in a nice, cool, safe, dry, dark place.
Thank you so much for an interesting talk. I'm Bonnie Engel, freelance writer. You mentioned all these South American countries where you can get it. Have you done any research in the somewhat more liberal countries of Southeast Asia where you can get almost everything else?
Yes, we have. And we've just the good thing about we've published a book online, which is one of the reasons why the Australian government is going to ban the online version. The online version allows us to change it every month. And so the version gets changed. And we've just included the... chapter on Thailand, and that's the photo of the drug that you get in Bangkok. And the address. And the address of the shop you need to go to. And the price, interestingly. Yes.
Doctor, good to see you again. Bernie.
Yes.
Bernie Lowe from Bloomberg TV. I'm just curious, when you were going to school, I mean, you have a dual... doctorate, PhD
yes.
in physics, correct?
Yes, that's right.
As well as an MD. You didn't set out to study medicine with the purpose of helping people kill themselves.
No.
So what was the turning point for you?
It's really one of those serendipitous things. I came through my training. I was from a background where people never went to university. And I was the first one in the family who went to university. And the options there, they said, well, you either do arts or you do science. And I did science. And I did quite well at science. And I ended up doing a PhD in physics. I always wanted to do medicine, but of course no one ever mentioned medicine. I didn't meet a medical student until I was halfway through my university course, and someone said, oh, what a good idea, I should have done medicine. So when I finally got, and then I worked for many years in other jobs and worked in as national parks and wildlife for a number of years, had a bad accident, was retrenched, and I thought, here's my last roll of the dice, I'll go back and do medicine, and did it when I was in my 80s as something of a geriatric student, the oldest student in that intake in 1984 in Sydney University, which had its own problems. But having graduated, then I went up to Darwin to do my interning years, and this happened around me. I switched on the radio one morning and said, oh, the leader of the government is about to introduce a law on euthanasia. And I thought, what a good idea. I'd been through the entire medical training and no one had mentioned the word euthanasia. It had not been, that's in 1984 to 1990, not been mentioned. And I just thought, like many people, thought, what a good idea. And so I was then totally taken aback. And how I got involved was really politically. I got totally taken aback by the sudden, extreme reaction from the Australian Medical Association that said, we are never going to let this law go anywhere. There's not a doctor in the territory who will support this legislation. And basically, we're going to wreck and thwart and frustrate it. And it was the arrogance of the medical profession who seemed to be saying to everyone out there saying, what a good idea, but it's the doctor saying, you think you know about death, but we're the experts, and we're the ones that are going to control whether you get this law or not. And it was the insufferable paternalism of the medical profession which annoyed me to such a degree that I found 12 other doctors. We took out a full-page ad in the local press and said, there are some doctors who agree with this, not many, but some. And then I became involved in the political process. And as I often am asked about, did you know, did you have experiences with sick and terminally ill people? And the answer is not really. It just seemed to me like a fundamental right. I know what I would want. I would want choice. I wouldn't want someone else coming along and saying, you can't have it. And of course, it's especially irking when it's people who have got that option themselves saying, well, we've got it, but you can't have it. And it's that idea that somehow or other you get the authority to have this control, access to these drugs if you come from a certain group in society, and then you exercise that elite nature of your position to control and restrict access of others. It's really that issue which drove me into it. Now I've got into it and I met all these people that are suffering and dying, and it just takes off.
Any more questions? Maybe one last question. Audine again.
Sorry, it's just, I'm sure a lot of us believe that for decades anyway, the medical profession has been quietly turning machines off
yes.
when it made sense.
either on their own account or because the family begs them
yes.
to or whatever. Why shouldn't that just be allowed to continue? Why should the process be outed?
Well, look, it certainly has been going on. And the process you refer to, I mean, in a sense, people making quiet behind the scenes, under the carpet decisions, has been going on. There's by and large been quite a satisfactory and effective defence that the medical profession could use, and that is that they act under the guise or the so-called doctrine of double effect, which says that as long as your prime intention is not to bring about death, as long as your prime intention is to relieve suffering, if death should occur as a secondary consequence, that's okay. And what that means in practice is that if a doctor says, well, you've got a lot of pain, I'll give you some morphine. Oh, it didn't work. Let's double the morphine. Oh, it didn't work. Let's double the morphine. That relentless, slow increasing of a drug like morphine till death occurs, while the doctor maintains, my job is to just get on top of this intractable pain. I was in no way trying to bring about the death of the patient. That's the usual way it goes on in institutions. And people are always saying to me, oh, it goes on all the time. My grandmother was in hospital and there was a bit of a nod and a wink and there was an injection of morphine and peaceful death resulted. But when you look closely at the process, the only way such doctors, who are often quite courageous and compassionate doctors, but the reason they've got away with it is that they hide behind, and who blames them, because the laws are savage, this effective defence. So unless you're seized by some crazed desire to confess, it's really gauged whether you've broken the law on what your intention was. And if you sit there and keep restating the mantra, my intention was to simply relieve pain, it's not terribly popular with patients. What you're saying, it goes under the name of slow euthanasia. And it's got to be slow. The slower it is as you relentlessly increase the drug, the safer it is for the doctor. They're trying to titrate the level to meet what was needed. So, and also, the sicker you are when they start the process, the safer it is for the doctor. So by and large, when patients come along and you can say, well, you might get help from a doctor, but what it'll be is that you'll be in hospital. It'll be an institutional process. It'll take 2 weeks. You won't be in control. Even if you can find a doctor who wants to, under a nod and a wink, comply, they will make the decision if and when they start. You won't be in control. And eventually, death will take place. But there aren't all that many people who come along and see me and say, look, doc, I've decided it's awful and I want to die and I want to spend 2 weeks doing it. People, by and large, when they decide to die, want the peace and comfort of knowing that when you take that drug, you will die. And when people take Nembutal, and I've seen a lot of people drink Nembutal, I've never seen them finish their whiskey. It's fast. If you're going to make an eloquent last speech after you drink your Nembutal, make it before. You don't get a minute. You're asleep and death occurs. Whereas this process of doctors using morphine, which is also unfortunate because it gives to the broader population this rather false belief that morphine must be a good end-of-life drug, and it's one of the worst, actually. Don't waste your time stockpiling morphine or other opiates that come from the opium poppy, including heroin. These are not good end-of-life drugs. The end-of-life drugs are the barbiturates. That's why you need a bit of information.
Why are they not good?
They're unreliable. They're unreliable and they're slow. People say, have I got enough? I've seen sick people, they're hoarding their morphine, they're not taking their nighttime dose, they're not telling their doctor, they've got dreadful cancer pain. I get there and they pour out 1,000 or 10 or 20 morphine tablets and say, surely I've got an end-of-life option. And I say, how long's a piece of string? People vary hugely in their sensitivity to the opiates. And so what one person will take will then bring about their death. Another person will take and they won't even know they've taken something. And the one thing people want when they go down this course is certainty. They don't want to mess around. They don't want to try something that might work. They want to have a certain outcome, and morphine and the other opiates don't provide it. And that includes heroin. People say, why don't I just go and get some heroin? People are always dying using heroin. They are dying using heroin, but they're not trying to. By and large, it's an unpredictability of heroin. And of course, also, heroin has to be injected, and people by and large can't do that. And if you eat heroin, it turns into morphine, so why not take morphine tablets? No, the opiates are not good drugs. And that's, we've got a whole section in the book trying to say to people, don't believe the urban myth about morphine. Forget it. Use morphine for what it's good at, giving you a good time or relieving your pain. Don't use it to bring about a peaceful death. Go out and get the barbiturates.
What about the stuff you find in operating rooms,
fentanyl? Fentanyl is another opiate, so that's not a good one. But there is in operating use the induction agent, which is thiopental, which is very close to this. And in fact, if you see this drug injected, the effect is the same as in an operating theatre. If you've ever had an operation, when the anaesthetist says to you as they inject the propofol or thiopental, count back from 10 and you go 10, 9, 8, and most of you can't remember past 8. It's fast, and that's a barbiturate. Yes, that's a good one.
Phenobarbital, right?
Phenobarbital is a different drug again. That's a drug which is an anticonvulsant, which is still around, and it does work, but it's slow. The one that's used in the operating theatres is thiopental, but the best of them all is pentobarbital.
Okay, we just have time for one very, very quick one.
Yeah. Aileen Bridgewater, sorry, I forgot to say. How do doctors justify giving euthanasia when they've sworn the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, obviously, if they're going to use this process that I've just outlined, they're not going to be called upon to explain it because they're saying, I was not trying to bring about the death of the patient, I was just trying to bring about a relief of their pain. And they're doing it in a way which there will be an inevitable outcome, which is death. The Hippocratic Oath, though, of course, is such a contentious document. Many medical schools don't take it. I never took the Hippocratic Oath. We don't do it because it's a changing, evolving document. When Hippocrates first brought it down, he said such interesting things like, doctors shouldn't cut the skin. That rules out surgery. Women shouldn't practice medicine. He said a lot of things. It's changed now. It's a oath in evolution, and so much has it evolved from its original concept that many places don't ask it. But the point you're referring to is do no harm. That's the usual condition of the oath that people point to. My argument to that is that if you're going to abandon a patient at that final stage when they ask that last and most important thing of you, you say, I can do everything for you up until the minute when you say things are so bad, now I want a peaceful death, and you just walk away and turn your back on them, that's abandoning a patient. So if you're doing no harm, you engage with patients and you respect them even when they ask that most hardest of question.
That's great. Thank you very much. And on behalf of the club, I'd like to present you with a small token, souvenir.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very
much. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
收上你個細台，收到啊！